Radicals and Refugees, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The lure of joining groups like ISIS can be strong, and American cities need to be prepared.
We believe every city should have a hotline, and every city should have a rapid intervention team.
Also, some say Syrian refugees coming to the U.S. are a threat, but the process is so slow and so complicated that
if you're a terrorist and you're any good at your job and you're trying to get into the U.S., you are not using the refugee process.
Plus, Brazil goes into almost full political meltdown, and Brazilians say, eh.
This is a country where people hate their politicians, and the Congress is largely seen as a sort of a sad telenovela sideshow just to sort of be watched and pay some attention to.
That's all today here on The World. One day last year, Muhammad Jamal Qais left his home in suburban Virginia for a trip to Europe. Then last month, his parents were greeted at their doorstep with the news that their son had joined and defected from ISIS. Kurdish Peshmerga forces reportedly found him in Iraq and took him into custody. Here's Qais speaking on Kurdish TV last month.
I made a bad decision. I made the decision to go because I wasn't thinking straight.
Qais is a 26-year-old American of Palestinian descent, and if he returns to the U.S., his case raises questions about how the U.S. deals with ISIS defectors. One major question is, how do we know they're not actually still loyal to ISIS? I spoke about this with Anne Speckhart. She directs the International Center for the Study of Violent Extremism.
I was just in Belgium and missed the explosions at the airport by an hour. So I'm glad I didn't go early to the airport. But I was interviewing parents of people that went to Syria, and one of them told me that her kid wants to return. He's a commander in ISIS, and he wants to return. He's married. He has a child there. But he's got to find a way to smuggle all three of them out, and it's not easy because they can't just pass as normal Syrians. They're Europeans. And I talked to police and counter-radicalization people there and said, I interviewed this woman and I'm really concerned about it. How can she get the help that she needs to help her son to come out? And, you know, what do you recommend? And one counter-radical official told me, be very careful, Anne, if you're helping her, because I helped in a case like that. The guy was calling me. We got him across the border into Turkey. He turned himself into the Belgian consulate. And it turned out that when they went through his phone and went through all his internet records and investigated him thoroughly, that he still was fully in ISIS and he was plotting against Belgium, and he had people back home that he was trying to organize to make an attack. I don't think that Mohammed Qais was dispatched, but, you know, it's not something that we should assume that it's not being done.
Give us a sense of how many Americans go and join ISIS. Do we have reliable data on that?
I think it's something like 400 or 500 have attempted.
Total, and yeah.
Yeah, it's a pretty small number compared to per capita, where a small country like Belgium has 500 that have gone, 125 have returned. Half of them are on the streets. And one of them I just interviewed that had returned, he spent 5 weeks there. And he is still highly radicalized. And I thought, my God, what is he doing on the streets? And I do believe that we should intervene with people. But I think, you know, if you've given significant support and given your buyout to a terrorist group, you probably need to spend some time incarcerated.
Right. But I mean, talk a bit about how the U.S. is dealing with the case of Muhammad Jamal Qais, because it's a kind of, does he go to jail for joining ISIS, or do we get him involved in some way in the counter messaging against ISIS?
As far as I know, he's still in Kurdish hands. So the first thing is he going to be turned over to us? Second thing is, do we prosecute him, which I think that we definitely will. And I do believe that these cases should be prosecuted. But then, you know, you may want to offer some kind of a plea bargain or reduce sentencing in exchange for going out and speaking to the public. And we do have a precedent with that, with the Lackahanna Six. There is one of them that goes out speaking, but he always has an FBI agent at his side.
These were the guys who were arrested up around Lake Erie, if I'm memory serves.
And they went and joined Al-Qaeda and went to their training camp and also became disenchanted. And the one gives a very good talk about why he went in and that it wasn't a good choice.
And do we know if that's kind of inhibited kids from joining Al-Qaeda or ISIS?
Well, I would imagine that it would. I mean, the insider story of, you know, it didn't work out so good for me. And you see me presenting myself here with the FBI agent at my side, and I spent time behind bars. And, you know, that's no fun.
What about the parents or relatives of people who've become radicalized or are about to become radicalized? I mean, those parents are often in shock. They seem to feel really isolated because they've suddenly discovered this ne'er-do-well right in their own family. What help does the U.S. offer them?
We believe every city should have a hotline and every city should have a rapid intervention team, because most family members have a good idea that something's wrong, but they don't want to call law enforcement. And you can understand why they don't want to call the FBI, because they might be setting their son or daughter up for a sting operation or to spend time in prison, where what they really want is treatment. They want someone to come and say, you know, you got Islam all wrong. We understand that this extremist group is meeting your needs. Can we redirect you to other things that will meet your needs in a more useful way that won't be self-destructive to you?
Anne Speckhard is the director of the International Center for the Study of Violent Extremism. Anne, thanks very much for your thoughts.
You're welcome, Marco.
Fears that ISIS is trying to infiltrate its fighters into the U.S. is making it harder for legitimate refugees to find asylum in the U.S. Becca Heller heads the International Refugee Assistance Project and joins us from New York. I'm sure you've heard this question time and again, Becca. The Obama administration wants to increase the number of Syrian refugees it permits into the U.S., but how can we be sure these asylum seekers aren't part of a terrorist group?
The process that refugees go through to get vetted is more extensive than anyone else coming into the United States. So if you're a terrorist and you're any good at your job and you're trying to get into the U.S., you are not using the refugee process. Most of the refugees that are trying to come in are themselves victims of the terrorists that we're trying to fight. The Islamic State, they're fleeing Al-Qaeda. And I think by failing to let them in and help them out of their plight, we are furthering the mission of terror.
Yeah, so increasingly, do you think that the media are conflating refugees and terrorists? Why is this happening?
This is definitely what the Islamic State wants. After the Paris attack, they left the false passport of a refugee at the scene to try to pin it on a refugee. It's very much playing into the plans of the Islamic State for us to conflate people fleeing them with terrorists, and we're allowing ourselves to be fooled. I don't think it's just the media that's perpetuating that.
Well, in Washington, it's been 6 months since the White House pledged to increase the number of Syrian refugees it permits into the U.S., bringing that number to 10,000. How's the White House doing on that promise?
I think they are making some effort to get it done, but the proof is really in the pudding. So far, we're halfway through the fiscal year, and out of our goal of 10,000 Syrian refugees, we have admitted 1,285. So we're going to need to see the numbers pick up pretty significantly in order to actually make the 10,000 number by the time the fiscal year ends on September 30th.
Why has Canada been able to take in so many more Syrians?
I think Canada allocated the resources necessary to do it. I think that right now the administration is kind of making the right moves and talking a good game about the resources that they're allocating, but we haven't seen that play out in the actual number of arrivals. You know, Canada, which is a country that's used to processing many fewer refugees than the United States, was able to take in 25,000 people in 4 months. That's in part due to their system of private sponsorship, but that only accounted for about 9,000 of them. The Canadian government was still able itself to process 16,000 refugees in 4 months, which is, you know, 400% of what the U.S. has done.
You know, in the context of low numbers of Syrians resettled here, do you have one refugee story that turned out well?
We've resettled, you know, or helped resettle over 3,000 people. So there are thousands of stories that have turned out well. We had one case of a woman who was rejected allegedly because she had committed a crime. And the crime was actually that a man that had kidnapped her and forced her into a marriage had sued her for alimony once she escaped, and that a Saddam Hussein regime had found her guilty of owing this man money. And the U.S. saw that she had a criminal record under the Ba'athist regime and rejected her as a potential criminal. We were able to win her appeal, and she was resettled to the U.S. a few months ago, where she's been reunited with her family, which includes a number of U.S. citizens, and she's thriving. And really, so are thousands of other refugees who we've helped resettle to a number of different countries. I think refugees are inherently survivors. They're people who have been through things that we can't even imagine and who have gotten themselves out of those situations and into a neighboring country and are fighting so hard to try to start better lives. And we really owe them better than this.
Becca Heller heads the International Refugee Assistance Project. Thanks very much for your time, Becca.
Thank you so much for having me.
A lot of the news that we cover every week, the stories we just heard, for example, are linked to conflicts and war. And there is a common thread running through those stories, according to my next guest.
All of those stories come from countries that export oil.
That's Leif Wanar. He's the author of Blood Oil, Tyrants, Violence, and the Rules That Run the World, and is a professor at King's College London. Oil is everywhere in our lives, but it doesn't fluster most of us. Wanar says, though, oil does fluster many people in places around the globe that suffer from the resource curse, the paradox that countries who have lots of oil tend not to have much democracy or much development.
There's something about oil which is very dangerous to the people of the country, and that danger ends up spilling back onto us too. That's the resource curse.
Give us an example of something we in the U.S. consume that may not be totally obvious in this sense, but where there's a connection to oil. Like a bottle of European beer, where would you say is the blood, as in blood oil?
We think about spending money for oil when we go to the pump, but it's not just what we spend at the pump. When you think about it, oil is everywhere. So basically, if it's plastic, it's oil. Oil might be in my waistband or your glasses. It might be in your shoes. Everything that is transported with oil is also something that we pay for, where the money goes back to authoritarians or armed groups. And even food, people don't think about it. The food that we eat is grown with nitrogen that is fixed from oil. So probably the grains that went into that bottle of European beer were grown with nitrogen from oil. Oil is everywhere in our life, and that means whenever we go to the checkout, we might be financing the spread of ideologies which are hostile to our way of life.
You write this about oil and oil companies. International oil and mining companies are flying, trucking, and sailing away billions of dollars of stolen wealth every day. Explain why that is stealing if those multinational companies have entered legal contracts with those nations.
Yeah, it's not the companies that are doing the stealing. It's actually the authoritarians and the armed groups in places like Saudi Arabia and Iran and Libya. This is the rule that says we'll buy oil and other resources from anyone who can control those resources by force. I mean, if you and I went and got some guns and took over a gas station down the street, no one thinks that we should get the legal right to sell off the oil and keep the money. But when Gaddafi took over Libya in a coup, the world started buying Libya's oil from him. And then years later, when rebels during the Arab Spring took over those very same wells, we started buying oil from the rebels.
So you've got this idea known as a clean hands trust. Explain that. And do you see that as a way to fix things?
So the first and most important thing for us to do is to pass a Clean Trade Act, which would just peacefully, responsibly taper off our oil imports from authoritarian countries. We don't need authoritarian oil anymore.
So you're saying U.S. and Canadian oil is pure and less compromised than those other countries? I mean, I would like to hear from people who live in the backyards of some of those oil fields in the tar sands of Canada.
Yeah, so there's definitely lots of problems around fossil fuels and oil in particular. As we know, huge controversies around there. We do need to get off fossil fuels as quickly as we can for environmental reasons, for sure. We need to tackle both of these issues at the same time. Climate change is urgent and the spread of violent extremism is urgent. The most important priority for getting out of business with the extremists of the world is to stop sending our money to whoever it is happens to have the most guns.
Leif Wanar, the author of Blood Oil, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks so much, Marco. It's been a pleasure.
Just ahead on the show, the source of the most expensive hair on the world. One town, 11 suicide attempts, and 9 of them involve minors. That's what happened this past weekend in the northern Ontario town of Ottawapiskat. It's a native or First Nations community, as they say in Canada. The town has declared a state of emergency because this crisis sadly goes beyond this one weekend. Since last September, about 100 suicide attempts in Attawapiskat. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has called the situation heartbreaking and pledged to work to improve living conditions for all Indigenous peoples. Jackie Hokemau lives in Attawapiskat. Her great-niece Sheridan took her own life last year. She was 13.
On Saturday, I was at home. I was with one youth, and she had a history of being involved with these overdosing. And I tried to help any way I can. As Native people, we support each other. So sometimes we take in youth. And then that day, I noticed this girl was sort of agitated. She was restless. She kept shaking her legs around. And I felt uneasy. And at that time, I had my pack sack with me. I had all my prescription medications there. And I was hiding them. Like in my own house, I have to start hiding my pills because I'm scared because somebody will steal them. And sure enough, I heard when she didn't come home, the police phoned me at 3 a.m. that she had overdosed, you know. The next day when I was walking around, I heard that they were young kids that went outside the community outskirts and they wanted to hang themselves. Somebody spotted them on time and the police were informed and they were picked up right away. They tried to hang themselves.
So that young woman, she overdosed. Did she kill herself?
No, she survived it. She's doing okay. But when you do this twice, the hospital will send you out and then you go through a psychiatric assessment. Like Canada now, they need to act upon and do something. This cannot be tolerated anymore.
What kind of support are you getting from the federal government into the community? I mean, have counselors arrived to help?
That's what I heard. I would see that as a Band-Aid solution right now when they're bringing in counselors. It might be overrated to pathologize Native people as suffering from mental health because First Nation people are traumatized by these oppressive conditions. And we need to go back to our tradition, how we left before, to look for answers. And I believe this is what, when our youth were walking on the ice road, like it was all youth from neighboring communities because there's suicide in their communities.
This was a healing walk you undertook,
right? What happened when they arrived in Attawapiskat, we had a feast for them. They were crying. They were heartbroken. They said, we don't want to die. We don't want to lose any more of our people from suicide. And then one girl, my niece, who lost her little sister, Sheridan, when she spoke, she broke down. She's so devastated. When she was crying, the drum slowly started to beat. And then each youth that was sitting at the front, one by one, they got up and they went to my niece. They went around her. They hugged her. And then the drum got louder and louder and the circle got bigger and bigger. And for me, this is powerful. This is healing.
Well, you talk about traditional ways. I mean, the healing walk you organized after a string of suicide shows how young people themselves are doing their best to support each other.
We cried together. We comforted each other. We gave each other hope.
Jackie Hokemau lives in Attawapiskat in northern Ontario. Thank you very, very much, Jackie, for speaking with us.
Okay, thank you very much.
Don't know if you ever saw the incredible comic documentary Good Hair. You should if you haven't. It's a story told by comedian Chris Rock of the tresses and extensions worn by mostly African-American women. There are fake extensions, and then even more in demand and far more pricey is the real hair that women, especially in India, grow out on their heads and then cut and sell to wholesalers who ship it to America. My BBC colleague Justine Long went to one of the Hindu temples in India where a lot of these hairy deals go down.
The Tirupati Temple is the largest temple in India for the offering of hair to the gods.
Tirupati Temple is also the largest collector of human hair in the world, 500 tons a year, and every month the pilgrim's hair is sold off to the highest bidder in online auctions. The temple earns about $4 million a year from it. Pilgrims sit before rows and rows of barbers in crowded, noisy halls called Kalyan Katan, or places of happiness. Hair is very much part of most Indian women's identities. Great care goes into looking after it and growing it. It is considered a virtue for Indian women to have long hair. It is a sign of great beauty. And sacrificing hair to the gods is the ultimate sign of humility and religious devotion. In return, people hope to be granted good fortune.
Lady here with her baby, she's just had her hair cut. They've got strands of hair covering their faces. You've just come out of having your hair done.
Yeah.
Why did you go to have it done?
I wish to give hair to God.
After you have had your head shaved, how does it feel?
It's a nice experience, but little bit my beauty is gone.
How long was your hair?
3 feet.
Do you know that the hair gets sold?
Yeah, I know that.
Is it okay that someone else is wearing your hair?
Yeah, it's okay. It's okay.
Most of the virgin hair weaves and wigs worn in Africa and the world come from India. It's the world's largest exporter of human hair. The temple hair is called Remi hair, and it is considered the best in the world. Because it is shaved from the scalp, the cuticles all fall in the same direction, and it mimics the exact feel of how the hair is on your head, making it perfect for wigs and weaves. Some of the temple hair ends up here in Raj Hair International's Chennai factory. The head of operations, Mr. T.V. Subramanian, takes me through the extensive process the hair must go through to become wigs, weaves and extentions.
Is this one woman's hair?
Yeah, it is kept in one bundle, and the bundle is taken, it is sorted out.
There must be 20 women here sitting on little wooden stools, all in their saris, shower caps on and face masks, and each one of them has a blue crate filled with hair. I mean, this one woman next to me here now is like pulling knotted hair apart.
After the hair is sorted, it is washed 12 times with mineral water to try to ensure that it remains as fresh as it was on a woman's head. It is then left to air dry.
The most expensive hair.
Yeah.
It's natural curly hair.
And it's long.
And it's long.
Incredibly long.
38
inches.
It is, I mean, 38 this is, inches.
And what's the value of this? I've got four bunches here. What's the kind of value of this?
A kilo of hair must be around $1,200.
That's why you call it black gold.
Absolutely.
The other black gold. That latter-day Rapunzel story, courtesy of my BBC colleague Justine Long at the Tirumala Tirupati Temple in southern India. You are listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman, a reporter who covers refugees and knows what it's like. She crossed from Afghanistan into Iran 30 years ago.
I refused to drink the desert water because it was too salty. And when we finally got to Iran, they brought us buckets of water. And like a dog, I just stuck my head in there and drank.
Her story, ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Springtime for much of the globe signifies new life and hope. But in Afghanistan, it also brings something that's downright terrifying, the Taliban Spring Offensive. It's basically a new fighting season for the militants after the forced break of winter. The Taliban actually made an official announcement today to launch this year's campaign. Majib Mashal reports from Kabul for the New York Times. He says this year's Spring Offensive is starting off a little differently than in the past.
The difference this year is that there was never really a winter lull. It's been a continuous fighting, unlike previous years where the fighting would slow down and then there would be official launch of spring. So in one way, people are not so worried because the fighting never stopped. In other ways, it's also a sign that if this is just the launch of a new season, then probably the violence will be much more than what it was during the winter. In most calculations, it's going to be a difficult year ahead because the Taliban refused to sit down for talks this winter. And they see this coming year as an opportunity to further test the Afghan forces, who are increasingly on their own with the NATO mission here drawn down to an advisory role.
When you get out of cities like Kabul, how popular is the Taliban these days in Afghanistan?
Not very, because the Taliban increasingly is turning into sort of a blur of insurgency / mafia. They have a pretty strong hold on the narcotics trade in parts of Afghanistan. So the people see that. The people see that every time the Taliban are offered an opportunity to come to the table and try to negotiate a settlement, they don't take that opportunity. And they continue to inflict violence. And a lot of that violence, yes, some of the violence is against security forces, and that's a war. But a lot of the violence on a daily basis takes the lives of ordinary average citizens. And people see that that combined with the narcotics interests and combined with Pakistan's leadership based outside Afghanistan. So all those factors playing in does not give the Taliban good popularity.
So if the people don't particularly like the Taliban, what gives the group its enduring strength?
Well, they are an old insurgency now. So they have pretty well established networks across the country, and the lack of economic opportunities kind of perpetuate that cycle where young men could rely on the Taliban for that income. I'm not saying the Taliban or their foot soldiers, it's largely economic driven, but that plays a factor. And the fact that there continues to be a foreign presence here gives them that ideological pretext also.
Will Afghans, you think, notice an uptick in violence?
I think so. I think it's a little early because the announcement just came today, and it'll take probably a couple of weeks before they go full-fledged into the violence. But I think there will be an uptick in violence, and when we speak to security officials, they are expecting an uptick.
And people who can't tolerate the violence and who have the money, I suppose a lot of them leave?
Yes. There has been a pretty big wave of people, mostly young people and middle-class people, leaving the country over the past couple of years, partially because of the rise in insecurity and partially because of another political disappointment. They thought we had a pretty messy election in 2014. That election threatened to unravel the country. But finally, they reached a coalition sort of settlement. And people thought, okay, we went through this. Now is going to be the good times. You know, they're going to work together to figure out and put the country on the right track. The problem is that the future looks bleak with every day because these two leaders in the coalition government just can't sort it out. They continue fighting each other. So this wave of people leaving, it's not just the insecurity. It's not just the economic hardship. It's also the lack of faith and belief in a decent future, because it's just everything is lost so much in the infighting.
Mujib Mashal in Kabul for The New York Times. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
As we just heard, many Afghans are leaving because of all the uncertainty in their country. Tens of thousands of them have made their way to Turkey, with Europe as their eventual destination. But that looks increasingly uncertain, too, as Europe tries to close the door on refugees. In Istanbul, there's a neighborhood that's become a hub for Afghans escaping war. Reporter Fariba Nawa recently visited a restaurant there where Afghans gather to talk and eat some familiar food.
Devlet Timuri is known for his hobli palau, the signature Afghan rice with carrots, meat, and raisins. He's head chef and manager here at Uzbek Sofrasi. Timuri stirs the rice in a large pot. A microwave hums in the background. He says many of the customers who come in are determined to go to Europe. He tells them it's better to stay in Turkey.
Life is thankfully peaceful here. People can find work, and Turks are good people.
Timori's kitchen faces out to the customers, so he can hear the conversations. And he says the stories break his heart. One afternoon, three Afghan men walk in. They live in Europe now, but they've come to Istanbul searching for information about their missing relatives. On February 8th, an overloaded boat en route to Greece capsized 2 miles from the Turkish coast. This is Harun. He didn't want to give his last name. He says 14 members of his family were on the boat. He located the bodies of 9 of them at morgues and hospitals. One was his sister's. But he's hoping that her 14-year-old son, Masoud Dilawari, may have survived. He shows me an article from a newspaper that mentions a teenager rescued in Greece who resembles his nephew. But the article is months old. At a nearby table, Tamim Nai listens in. He's an Afghan psychology student in Istanbul. He's been in Turkey for 3 years. And at times he's been hungry and homeless. But he doesn't want to go to Europe. He's found friends and work here now.
He
says he came here to make something of himself so he can help his family and his country. If he went to Germany, he would just be thinking of himself. But even if Nail wanted to go, it's unlikely that he could get there, now that Europe is turning back refugees as part of a deal with Turkey. Last week, about 42 Afghans were sent back from Greece. They don't know what their future will be. But one thing's for sure, Afghans will keep coming.
Fariba Nawa is with me now from Istanbul. So Afghans are still coming to Turkey, even with this new EU deal, Fariba. What's life like for them in Turkey?
Life is quite difficult, Marco. They are living in shacks and shanty towns with any Turks who are willing to house them. Most of them are considered illegal here, even though they've applied for registration as refugees.
So if you look at the Afghan refugees in Turkey and the Syrian refugees, how are things different for them? How is life different?
Life is different because Syrian refugees are given legal status as refugees, so they have access to free health care, to free schooling. Afghans, there's no government help for them.
Do Afghans resent the Syrian refugees?
I think in Greece, where they're all stuck together in camps, in very difficult situations, yes. In Turkey, it's more spread out. One thing that's really interesting is that Turkish citizens, Turks, seem to like Afghans better because they have a much friendlier history together and the numbers are not so big. Whereas their attitude toward Arabs and Syrians tends to be a lot more similar to what anti-immigrants in America might feel toward Mexicans.
Last week, we covered the arrival of that first ferry of Afghans who were sent back to Turkey from Greece. Do you know what's happened to them?
As far as I know, the media doesn't really have access to them. They are being held in this camp and they're being prepared to be deported just this
deported
weekend.
Deported back to Afghanistan.
The situation on the ground for all refugees in Turkey is unclear right now. This deal is something so new and so confusing for many people, including the journalists who are covering them. Things seem to be changing daily.
Fariba, you're Afghan, Afghan-American to be precise. You live in Turkey now. I know the story of these refugees is not your story, but does it in some way feel personal?
Absolutely, Marco. I grew up during the Soviet invasion. I watched my young classmates die in front of me. I watched my grandmother. We've had a lot of tragedy going 40 years back.
You were in Afghanistan during the invasion.
Yes, I was 9 years old when I left. And as I interview these refugees, it's surreal because I tend to have flashbacks to my own childhood and how we crossed the desert on donkeys. And I was so thirsty, I refused to drink the desert water because it was too salty. And when we finally got to Iran, my uncle's neighbors there brought us buckets of water, and like a dog, I just stuck my head in there and drank. And when we got there, my mom and dad finally told me that, you know, we could have been killed at any moment because we were crossing the front line. So as these young people that I meet tell me their stories, it's as if nothing's changed. The scenery's different. They're crossing the sea, but really, we've just gone back in history.
Reporter Fariba Nawa speaking with me from Istanbul. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, Marco.
A campaign to ban abortion is getting traction in Poland. And a new story in The Guardian highlights how both sides of the debate in Poland are taking pages and inspiration from pro-life and pro-choice activists here in the U.S. Daniel Gross wrote that story for The Guardian, and I asked him first why abortion is such a big issue in Poland, especially right now.
Abortion has been a big topic for the last 20 years in Poland, ever since the Catholic Church took a lot of control of politics in Poland. And just a year ago, Poland got a new ruling party, the Law and Justice Party. And ever since that party has been in power, the anti-abortion movement has gained traction. The current status of abortion in Poland is it's not a total ban. Women are allowed to have abortions when the pregnancy is a result of crime. For example, rape or incest, you're allowed to apply for an abortion. And if there's a serious health risk to the mother or to the fetus, you can also apply for an abortion. But the current campaign is pushing to get a bill in Parliament that would completely ban abortion.
Now, something that really struck me in your story for The Guardian was just how the pro-life side of the abortion debate in Poland is using U.S. tactics not just tactics, but imagery of the pro-life movement here. Talk about that.
So I was in Poland in 2014, and I sat down with this pro-life activist who's leading the charge. He runs this organization called Stop Abortion in Poland. His name is Mariusz Dzierżawski. And I asked him, what are your tactics? What kinds of things are you doing to fight abortion in Poland? And he said, they're actually not my tactics. They're from this American activist called Greg Cunningham, which is where we get all of our photos. And if you actually look at some of the photos used in anti-abortion protests in Poland, you'll see, you know, these gory fetus images that you see in the United States. And some of them have this, they have like a coin in the image to show how big the fetus is.
Right.
And they're American coins.
Wow.
This is in Poland. They're, you know, all the text is in Polish. And yet you see American coins on, you know, on the streets of Warsaw.
That's kind of extraordinary. So did he tell you what it is about this American style of activism that he appreciates, that he really kind of gloms onto?
Yeah, well, so Cunningham, this activist from the United States, he visited Poland in 2004, and he's been a big inspiration for the Polish movement. Cunningham is the man who came up with this idea of using graphic imagery to shock people. And that is the tactic that I think Polish activists have really harnessed for their movement.
What about the pro-choice side of the debate? What are their tactics, and how do they kind of counter this campaign of the pro-lifers?
One of the responses is actually pretty funny and very wry. The Facebook page of the prime minister, who's potentially in support of this ban, has filled with these comments of women reporting their periods to her. And so they'll say things like, oh, yeah, you know, I got my period this month. Everything's going well.
Wow.
Just wanted you to know.
Guerrilla style.
Yeah, exactly. But one of the other tactics actually also is an import from the United States. I spoke to a woman who said that coat hangers, which are the symbol of the brutal effects of illegal abortions, they weren't used in Poland because for 40 years under communist rule, abortion was accessible for women. So that's an
Wow.
image that really only exists in the United States, according to this activist. And yet it's just as potent a symbol in Poland as it is here.
Does it stop at borrowing kind of the optics of the abortion debate from the United States? Or is there actual communication between pro-life leaders in Poland and pro-life activists here in the States?
It doesn't stop at the level of just inspiration. These two men, Greg Cunningham and Mariusz Dzierżawski, are in regular email contact.
Mm.
And I think we have reason to believe that this is a collaboration.
Based on what you saw of this debate, and especially the pro-life movement in Poland, would you be surprised if this bill passes?
I wouldn't be that surprised if it passed. Based on the interviews that I've done, speaking with some of the activists on both sides, there's a strong possibility that if it makes it into parliament, it will pass, because currently the government is quite conservative and very Catholic and would consider this seriously. And so women are quite scared in Poland. You know, the women who are fighting for abortion rights are quite fearful. But on the other hand, they do say this could be a chance for movement in the opposite direction. So this could backfire. If women see that, you know, reproductive rights are being taken away from them, they may actually be able to get movement for liberalization of abortion rights in Poland.
Reporter Daniel Gross, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Marco.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Brazil's president, Dilma Rousseff, is a step closer to being thrown out of office. A committee of Brazil's lower house of Congress voted yesterday to recommend impeachment. The president is accused of using loans from state banks to mask government budget problems during her reelection campaign. Nobody is suggesting Rousseff personally pocketed any money. There are no corruption charges against her, but many of those pushing to impeach the president are under investigation for graft. Will Carlos is based in Rio for our Global Post team, and he's been following all of this pretty closely. Who are the main players in this impeachment saga, Will?
I think probably the main player is a guy called Eduardo Cunha. He is the guy who's sort of considered the gatekeeper to the impeachment process, and he's the guy who'd say, go ahead, let's start this game off.
Yeah, so pot calling the kettle black. If this guy, Eduardo Cunha, is accused of money laundering and corruption in another scandal, how is it that he's going after President Rousseff?
Isn't it just a wonderful saga? He's accused of having secret Swiss bank accounts. He's accused of taking about $5 million in bribes. Sitting Congress people here are afforded a very strong immunity, which allows them immunity from prosecution. They can only be prosecuted through the Supreme Court. And what that means in practice is that their prosecutions often take years. And you end up with a situation like you have in Brazil now, where something like 60% of sitting lawmakers are under some form of criminal investigation.
So how likely is it that the full House of Brazil will vote to impeach the president?
Well, that's the multi-million dollar question that everyone's trying to figure out. It's hard to guess anything in Brazil these days. I mean, the next 24 hours could prove crucial. The vote, I think, is going to go ahead on Sunday. That's a long time in Brazilian politics. Anything could happen between now and then. And it's literally the little backroom deals that could sway this vote one way or the other.
Yeah, what have you been hearing about those backroom deals and what's going on behind the scenes? Like, who's in a position to take over the presidency if Rousseff falls?
Well, one of the beautiful ironies of this is that the guy who takes over if Rousseff falls is a guy called Michel Temer, another guy who's also accused of corruption. A judge of the Supreme Court decided last week that he must face impeachment proceedings because, lo and behold, he was apparently involved in the exact same financial shenanigans that Dilma has been accused of. So we're faced with this bizarre situation where the vice president could take power only to be immediately impeached himself.
Incredible. So how are Brazilians dealing with it, Will? Kind of anxious or taking it all in stride?
I think they're probably split between trying to understand what on earth is going on, trying to keep up with it all, and really just kind of political apathy. I mean, this is a country where people hate their politicians, and the Congress in Brasilia is largely seen as a sort of a sad telenovela sideshow just to sort of be watched and pay some attention to. I think, to turn serious for a minute, the poorer people in Brazil should be paying very close attention, because if Dilma does fall and this guy Michel Temer takes over, his party has already hinted at reducing some of the welfare state that was brought in over the last decade plus. That could spell really bad news for the sort of everyday finances of a lot of Brazilian families. So, you know, it's a sideshow for the moment, but people may start to pay closer attention as they start to realize how this could actually impact their daily lives.
At the end of the day, Will, does any of this political drama affect the Olympics about 3 months away?
I think it affects it more in terms of the ticket sales. The ticket sales are very low at the moment. So Brazil faces a huge PR battle to try and convince people to come here, that it's not going to slip into some sort of chaos or civil war or something like that. That's going to be the battle.
Will Carlos in Rio with the World's Global Post team. Thanks for the update, Will.
Thanks, Marco.
Finally today, a song, Led Zeppelin's Stairway to Heaven, a band, an American group called Spirit, and a lawsuit. Here's the World's Clark Boyd.
It's one of the most famous riffs in rock. Led Zeppelin's Stairway to Heaven, often copied, never equaled. Just ask Wayne Campbell. Remember the no stairway sign in the guitar store in the movie Wayne's World?
No stairway. Denied.
The legend is that Led Zeppelin's Robert Plant and Jimmy Page wrote Stairway at an old farmhouse in Wales. Here's Page talking to the BBC about it.
I wanted to try to put something together which started with quite a fragile, exposed acoustic guitar.
Stairway was released in 1971. But here's the thing. A couple of years earlier, Led Zeppelin had toured with an American band named Spirit. And at the time, Spirit was performing a song, a 2-minute instrumental, called Taurus. Check out the opening. Right. Sounds a lot like Stairway. Randy Wolf, or Randy California, as he was also known, was the Spirit guitarist who wrote Taurus. He died in 1997, but a trustee for his estate has brought a lawsuit against Led Zeppelin. Michael Skidmore argues that Plant and Page got the idea from hearing Spirit perform Taurus. And he might have a point.
The bands went on tour together. That was
the kind of key thing. And, you know, Spirit was a reasonably well-known group at the time. So, you know, I mean, there's a lot of evidence for the fact that, you know, Jimmy Page would have heard this.
That's Rolling Stone's Anthony DeCurtis.
Led Zeppelin has a troubled record in this regard. You know, there have been any number of songs where they've, you know, had to add songwriting credits to other artists. So the fact that, you know, this is going to trial is a matter of concern for them, for sure.
Now, a federal judge in Los Angeles has ruled that a jury should decide. Judge Gary Klausner wrote, "While it is true that a descending chromatic four-chord progression is a common convention that abounds in the music industry, the similarities here transcend this core structure." But why now? I mean, Randy Wolf or his trustee could have brought a lawsuit a long time ago. Anthony DeCurtis says, "Thank Robin Thicke."
There's a receptive audience for these kinds of charges of, you know, musical plagiarism. You know, we had a case recently with Blurred Lines by Robin Thicke with, you know, the Marvin Gaye song, You've Got to Give It Up. You know, there was a tremendous settlement. And I think anybody who potentially has a copyright is thinking, well, gee, you know, if fans are saying this all over the internet, you know, I should take my shot in a court of law, you know, see what I can get from this.
The trial is scheduled for early next month. If Michael Skidmore, the trustee, wins, he'll only get 50% of any damages awarded. Oh, and for the record, No Taurus just doesn't have the same cachet as No Stairway. For The World, I'm Clark Boyd.
So we wind on down the road from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
Public Radio International.